Thank you for joining us today on At the Root of It. This is Aaron Fitzpatrick on the 1st of December on the Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Restaurant in Brooklyn. Hope everyone is recovering from their Thanksgiving holiday. I had a chance to have a Heritage turkey as well. Mine was quite delicious. We're going to begin today's show with the Weekend Wine recap. And in latest news, Decanter reported that the long-running conflict since 2003 between Chaume and Côte de Chaume in France's Loire Valley has been resolved. It has been decided by the regulating committee, INAO, that Côte de Chaume should become a Grand Cru, while Chaume will become a Premier Cru. The decision came after Côte de Chaume felt the village's superior status was undermined when Chaume was promoted to a Chaume Premier Cru. And in the crop report, also Loire in the news, Janssens Robinson writes that the Loire Valley has seen a great vintage in 2009, seemingly across the board in Europe. A classic year that started with a real winter, early summer storms, which included hail, and followed by a hot, dry summer, which ran all the way through the week of October till the end, third week of October. Yields are slightly lower than 2008, the reports the growers, but with excellent quality, ripe fruit, freshness, and bright purity. And in the market feed, according to new figures, the wine world is to be shrinking, with global consumption falling and total vineyard area decreasing 2009. The EU has devised a new compensation scheme to encourage growers to abandon non-profitable vineyards in the economic crisis. Some 73,000 hectares has estimated to have been wiped off the map of Europe in 2009. The compensation scheme was oversubscribed by more than double, with a further 55,000 hectares reduction expected to follow across Europe in 2010. We're going to take a quick break, but before we break, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch in San Simeon, California. And for listeners, please call in at 718-497-2128. During today's show with any questions or comments. Thanks. Say around a quarter to three, still so high, hypnotized in a trance from this body, so buttery brown and tantalizing. You would have thought I needed help from this feeling that I felt, so shook I had to catch my breath. Oops, there goes my shirt up over my Welcome back to At the Root of It on the Heritage Radio Network. And a big welcome to my guest this afternoon, Eben Freeman, one of New York's most acclaimed bartenders, and I'd say now world-renowned acclaimed bartenders. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you for having me out here at Bushwick.
Yes, my pleasure. Anytime. Welcome back from your recent travels. You're now splitting your time between New York and Asia.
I am, yeah. I've been back for a month, which has been fantastic.
Getting geared up for the winter.
Yeah, it's a beautiful day today. I love that cold temperature.
It is.
Love New York this time of the year.
I do too. There's a indulgence in the air.
Indeed.
So what have you been doing in Asia?
It's been exciting. For about the past 6 months, I've just been bumming around a lot, going over to Hong Kong and Bangkok and Singapore, Jakarta, looking around at the scene over there, trying to get a feel of what business is like, and just digging the upbeat vibe that you have in the restaurant and development scene over there, which sadly has departed our dear city here for a while.
So still, I've been over there recently myself, and I've noticed that there is still a lot of development. I know that the economic crisis hasn't necessarily surpassed Asia. They're still feeling it to some degree, but there is still a lot of development, it seems.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, what they're doing in Singapore right now, where all these chefs are going and where all this money is being spent, casinos and stuff like that, Singapore, Macau, it's insane the scale that people are working on over there right now. It's really mind-blowing.
And you feel like there is actually creativity involved in these new developments as well, or is it more of a transference of the celebrity chef kingdom to Asia since it's leaving the U.S.?
There's some of that. I mean, I think the real era of Vegas and the celebrity chef is sort of done.
I mean, these guys
aren't idiots. They're all working on a business model. That's part of the really interesting thing is sort of trying to navigate what I do through the corporate structure, because I really strongly feel that it's not just hotel groups that have this corporate structure. Now restaurants are being taken over by restaurant groups that are starting to act and think a lot the same way. So it's interesting to see what information I have for them and what they have for me. So there is definitely a corporate structure, but they definitely are very competitive. They want interesting things going on. They want the best of everything. Prestige is very important. Face is very important over there. So they definitely want things happening at their places, and they're more willing to take chances right now than anyone in the United States is in order to get there.
And because it's your world and your specialty, how have you felt the acceptance or support of cocktails has been? Is it something that is very exciting for them on a different level because they haven't seen it yet?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I realize in my time over there and talking to other bartenders and things like that, that there is some sort of a historical precedence involved in my being over there, which is, you know, they're calling this now the second golden age of the cocktail, and the first golden age being right before Prohibition. If you think about it, conditions are somewhat, you know, eerily reminiscent during those times, you know, tough economic times and also a downturn in the business here in the United States sent bartenders and people who were interested in restaurants over to Asia. People were traveling over to Asia because there was business over there at that time, and there wasn't as much going on at home. And you know, that's when there was a golden age in Asia. People think, you know, Asians don't have a history of drinking, but you look at the Singapore Sling, you know, you look at classic hotel bars that existed over in Asia, and certainly the scene in Japan that's very hot in the U.S. scene right now, you realize that there is a long tradition of bartending and cocktails over there. So really, for me, it was eye-opening to come from the States and think that they don't know cocktails, and, you know, they don't know how to, they physically can't process alcohol and all that sort of stuff. You get a reality check pretty quick, and mine came in the form of one night in Bangkok, where the world is not my oyster, but a couple of girls who appeared to be about 14 set down a bottle of scotch on the table and proceeded to drink me under the table. So that's when I realized
they like their scotch and whiskey in Asia.
Maybe
for
I didn't
sure.
understand the scene over there quite as well as I thought.
Well, I think that there's two places from my own experience, which I've noticed, you know, Hong Kong and Tokyo being very strong on that front, just in terms of more of a excellence and standard in serving and preparing cocktails. But do you see now it's getting more support or more exposure in places like Indonesia and Malaysia, places that may not have had that standard so long in history?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, again, everybody wants the best of everything. So all the attention that cocktails are getting in the United States and in food press, obviously, you know, from a development sense, they want that. And certainly the consumers there are now moving up economically on a scale where they want those things as well. And so they're going out, and there's definitely a lot more expendable income. Remember how many expats are over in those countries also that make up part of your clientele. But yeah, you mentioned Indonesia, and that to me was really eye-opening because you go over there and it's a, you know, it's a Islamic country and you expect there to be Muslim law. And yet there are fierce drinkers over there. I mean, unbelievable. You know, I think the adherence to Islamic rule is directly related to their economic situation, because there's clubs over there doing insane amounts of business, people drinking a lot of alcohol.
Yeah.
The government restricts somewhat who can be open and how booze can come in, but, you know, they're still
they're
doing
getting
it
away
over there.
To getting in there.
Oh, without question. And people would be like, oh, you know, that's not a place to party. And let me tell you, Indonesia is definitely an up-and-coming market with some really smart restaurant development people and a scene that is much more sophisticated than you'd expect it to be.
I know you've been in the business for quite some time, and dubbed by publications and media as the liquid magician, based on your propensity and talent in terms of making cocktails with a molecular mixology kind of spin. Can you kind of define that movement or that style for us a little bit and compare it to molecular gastronomy and the popularized by chefs such as Ferran Adrià and Wiley Dufresne?
Well, in the same way as if you'd talk to Ferran or Wiley right now, they'd say that the term and the whole sensation is really a creation of the media. I feel it's the same. So there's definite mm-hmm. parallels there as well with molecular mixology. It's really a misnomer. You know, it's something that's existed for a long time. The understanding of science, as simple as, you know, specific gravities and layering cocktails, was already there. So it really isn't as new as everybody wants to make it out to be. But mm-hmm. obviously it's a subject that's not as explored or exposed. And since we're in the age of total overexposure in regards to everything that's done in restaurants, it's sort of carried over to my field. So, you know, I'm really more of a restaurant bartender than a molecular bartender. And I was fortunate to work in environments with people where I could share their vocabulary. I think it's very important for a bartender to adapt his vocabulary to the vocabulary established by the chef. Mm-hmm. And you should do that wherever you are. And I just happened to work with some very interesting people who had some interesting ideas and, you know, like to think that I had somewhat of a talent at doing it and got some exposure. But that's really a small part of what I do. But it is something that is out there, and particularly in Asia, they're starting to see that as the American way of bartending has got to be something with foams or something blowing up and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, mm-hmm. I like to use whatever vocabulary is at my disposal to try and communicate what I'm trying to do in my work. And anyone who's serious about this job should really be doing the same. Same thing with chefs. That's fine if you're an ingredient-driven chef who doesn't care about molecular mixology. But if you were a heart surgeon and we were all sitting around and you started saying, you know, well, you know, these lasers and these cameras, that fancy stuff, you know, I don't do that. I keep it real. That would be seen as almost criminally irresponsible. I think it's the same way with chefs and bartenders. If you're really serious about your craft, you should explore every sort of discipline and technique that is out there.
Sure.
And,
well, there has to be a cohesiveness
whatever you want
between
to call it, molecular or not. Plenty of these mm-hmm. guys are starting to adapt and understand that this is a tool to really help them communicate whatever their language is in the mm-hmm. kitchen.
Was that your first experience at WD-50 with this sort of craft?
Yeah, I mean, at WD, it really, you know, it was great because, you know, Chef's father, Dewey, really gave me freedom and gave me the bar. And it was the first time where I could really do anything that I wanted to do. And yes, of course, I was influenced by what Wiley was doing and had already sort of taken an approach that's centered from the kitchen. And so, you know, I definitely, you know, started to get notoriety there. But a lot of the stuff that I started to get press on had nothing to do with chemicals or molecular. It may just be surprising, you mm-hmm. know. It may be the use of vegetables, which is something that Sam Mason certainly taught
with
me when
beet
I was
sangria,
there.
I remember that quite well.
Yeah, using beets, using butternut squash, you know, all these ideas sort of started from there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I said, I had a lot of tools at my disposal, be it chemicals or be it, you know, be it cryovac machines, and all of those things can help you do your work.
Do you have a favorite amongst those tools or gadgets?
I think the cryovac machine vacuuming is really an interesting way to do infusions and all sorts of applications. So if I had to choose one machine that I'd like to have for Christmas, and I'll send this out to my good people out of Berkeley if they'd like to send me a cryovac machine, that would be lovely to have around the house.
And as far as the bar being and the nucleus of the restaurant, as some have claimed, do you feel that it is?
I don't know that it's the nucleus, but it's definitely restaurants are only slowly starting to wake up to the idea that the bar is not just a place where you put customers before you seat them down to dinner, mm-hmm. that it is a revenue center, that it can be an interesting way to communicate their message to their customers. And they start to understand that for many customers, that's the only communication they do have with their restaurant is a drink or maybe an appetizer or something like that. And now now hotels, and, you know, what I've learned in Asia is now hotels are understanding that their restaurants, their bars, aren't just conveniences for their guests or where they put their guests before they go up to their rooms.
Yeah.
They need to be revenue sources also, and they can communicate their message to their guests as well, whatever that message may be.
Mm-hmm. And layer their experience after they've walked in the door and make them perhaps return after having dinner.
Exactly. Yeah. There is no better, easier way to get to the guest's heart, which is all part of branding, which institutions know well, than through the use of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, on that note, we're going to take a short break and return in a moment. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Returning with my guest, Eben Freeman, at the Root of It. And a quick thank you to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, as well as to our producer and engineer, Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener. And we just closed up the previous segment talking a bit about the growth and expansion in the Asian market with respect to bars and restaurants and Eben's experience behind the bar. Which leads me into my next question, thinking about the palates, the difference between U.S. and Asia, and how in your work there you are creating menus and cocktails to kind of be tailored to these different palates.
Well, the list of ingredients and opportunities there is incredible. And the first time you go to a market in Thailand and see all of the flavors that are available, it's overwhelming. It's, you know, it is the kid in the candy shop, you know, where you're just like, I can just take any of this and muddle it in some booze and, mm-hmm. and we're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
So the quality of ingredients is incredible. You know, I never understood what a star fruit was because yeah. we get ones made out of wood here in the United States that act as garnishes
terrible.
Until you
yeah.
taste one, you know. You've never had a mangosteen until you've had it over there. It's mm-hmm. just not the same thing. So, I mean, that's fantastic. And then you look at all the cultural history, and a lot of people make the assumption, Asia, I've got that figured out. It's, you know, it's soy sauce, it's mirin, it's, you know, sake, you know. Don't think about all the different influences that been. What a huge trading outpost Asia has been. You look at Singapore. It was great making drinks in Singapore because I could do Indian references. I could do Middle Eastern references. Mm-hmm. I could do Dutch references. You know,
things
really,
all along the trade route.
Oh,
the
totally.
Space, yeah.
So you have all those cultures to work with and the rich history that people have in major metropolitan areas anyway, you know, in places like Hong Kong, they've had influences there. So as a New Yorker, it's great because you realize that a lot of that vocabulary I grew up with, they grew up with even, you know, more intense. So mm-hmm, I think the real thing that you learn from an Asian palate is how incredibly complex it is and how what a fine-tuned instrument it is where they really need levels of flavor. And, you know, you really see in Bangkok where, you know, you go there and you eat and you think it's just spicy food. But when you really taste all the different types of cuisine, you realize how many layers there are within that spicy cuisine once
sure.
you start to tune your palate to it. And so you realize that, you know, flavors and ideas that worked well in the States that hit a single notes don't work well over there.
Yeah.
And you don't get discouraged. You don't say, oh, they don't like bitter flavors, which in general Asians do not.
Right.
They do like bitter flavors. They don't like to see the word bitters. Like mm-hmm. like Americans are crazy about bitters right now. You don't put the word on the cocktail list, but put them in there. They really respond to it. And bitter flavors work. They just have to be layered with other flavors and other textures. You know, they love texture there. So you realize that you can make drinks, you know, you just have to really adapt them and make them more three-dimensional. And that's been great training for me over there. And yeah, there are regional differences. You know, Singapore is definitely a different market than Hong Kong is.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Jakarta, you have such a rich spice trade down there, you know, things like nutmeg, clove, you know, you know, you've got different influences that are heavier there, but you know, there is, you know, a real multiculturalism over there that people don't, we imagine that they're drones of people building cars and television sets, you know, don't understand how really complex Asian culture is and Asian society is. It's really, really difficult to navigate.
Well, I think there's a perception too that, you know, Asians are more prone to things that are sweeter. And maybe that comes from, as you mentioned, this source of fresh fruit and fresh product, which is natural sweetness.
Yeah.
You know, not a cloying sweetness, but something which is well balanced with acidity, for instance. You
well,
know?
You know, I think every culture has this idea that, you know, oh, they like things sweet. You know, most of the world says, oh, Americans like things sweet.
They do.
Because we drink so much soda, we eat so much candy.
Yep.
So for us to say, I mean, how much sweets do you see being consumed in Asia?
Mm-hmm.
So to say that they like sweet more than they do, you know, the British always say, oh, you like sweets over there. It's like, you guys grow up drinking, you know, blackcurrant syrup and, you know, treacle and all sorts of sweet, sticky, disgusting things, you know, so,
orange,
you know, without question, there is a lot of, you know, what I would call chick drinking going on over there. People
right.
who don't want a lot of alcohol in their drinks and people who want sweeter flavors. And certainly lychees are all over cocktail lists over there. But, you know, there is that same consumer will have something as long as you add complexity to it, as long as it isn't one, you know, note of strength of alcohol. If there is some sweetness, if there's some sourness, they really do understand balance better than you'd think. So if you give them a balanced product with any consumer, you're going to be much easier off making it sweet. But think about the way that Asians eat, and it isn't very sweet
right.
at all. Fruit is about as sweet as they usually get.
Indeed. Well, I had the good opportunity to work with you on an event in June called the Cocktail All-Stars. So I wanted to also spend a few minutes talking about this initiative, which has just been growing this past year.
Yeah, it's been great fun to be over there, and everyone in the world is interested in what's going on over there and wants to be part. So it really is not hard to encourage friends to come and visit over there and see what's going on. In the cocktail scene, Japanese is huge right now. So
yeah.
Anywhere near that, bartenders are interested in. And, you know, fortunately, I've met a lot of people in this industry. I know a lot of people in this industry over 20 years. So being able to do, you know, bring different people over and spread the idea of that culture in Asia has been great. So, you know, I've had, you know.
So what is it exactly? What is the Cocktail All-Stars?
Well, you know, it's sort of a strategic events idea that we do, in which we really want to go into different market, and we really want to bring some interesting people to do stuff in different properties. And, you know, we may do something at a big hotel and then do something at a smaller hotel or a smaller restaurant or bar later on and do something casual as well. But the whole idea really is to bring what is a phenomenon, which is the American bar scene right now, and bring it over to Asia. And the scene in London, the scene in Sydney are really huge right now, established, and just expose people to a little bit of that culture, you know, and hopefully really change the way that they think about drinking. And that's, for me, the most exciting thing about Asia is the idea that you do have people who are just really starting their drinking careers, on a serious sense. I mean, shochu is supposedly the most consumed spirit in the world. So again, there's people drinking
astounding?
Over there.
Yeah.
But in terms of making them the cocktails and making their drinks, it really hasn't been a phenomenon over there, except for the very wealthy hanging out in the hotels. So the idea that you can actually affect the way an entire culture thinks about drink is really profound. And being able to, you know, create excitement through these events, and then, you know, hopefully be able to introduce flavors and really test out for us. I get to see on these people what works with them and what doesn't. And like I said, I'm really encouraged by how many of the ideas that I thought up in New York with Asian influences actually do well over there. So things like garam masala Mai Tais that I make, you know, the soy caramel and the kumquat caipirinha that Sam and I developed together.
That one's fantastic.
It's great to see that that do well over there, you know, because you imagine you have that palate. So it's really encouraging to see people respond to that, and really encouraging to see how people are learning and getting more sophisticated, and that I may get the opportunity to somehow be a part of that is really, really intoxicating. No pun intended.
So a global collective of talent from different cities that have fantastic people behind their bar programs and bringing them together to do pop-up events and planned events.
Yeah, we've had Jimmy in from New York. Cultures, you know, we've had Ryan Fitzgerald from around SF. I love the SF scene out there. Big up to my friends out in San Francisco.
You know,
working with people in London, Lyndon Pride down in Australia. Got to go to the Sydney Bar Show. Had a great time in Sydney and got to go to Neil Perry's restaurant and eat one of the best restaurants I've been in a year. I mean, it's really exciting what's going on. It really is a great time to be in my line of work, and it's really exciting to see how people are responding to it and that it does have longevity to it.
It sounds like maybe we might be up for one here in New York as well in the winter, hopefully.
I'm a New Yorker. I'm definitely going to be back in New York. You know, we're talking about doing Cocktail All-Stars here in the next couple of months in New York at a few different venues, inviting some of our friends over and just being able to show people stuff that I've been working on and ideas. We definitely want to do that. And, you know, I'm definitely going to establish some more work, you know, and establish something here in New York because my family's here, born and raised here. I love New York. It's a beautiful day out. It's nice and 45 degrees, which feels great after the heat of Singapore.
Indeed,
so, you know, I love this city and this country and intend to come back and continue the explorations that we started.
And then one last note before we finish. With the amount of people the past year here in the States experimenting with, you know, wine cocktails and sustainable produce and things that are more locally sourced. Is that as much of a priority these days in Asia?
They want part of that same idea. Obviously, you know, it's funny how many cocktail lists you go and they've got mojitos and margaritas and it's like, why are you doing this when you've got these local products? So, you know, anytime you travel, you realize people don't want to hear about New York. They want to tell you that they've been there to show you how cultured they are, but they really don't want to hear you preach about this is what we're doing in New York.
Like it's superior.
They want to hear that you love the flavors, that you've been to their local noodle houses, that you've been to the little dive bars, that you really understand their flavors, and they love to see it on cocktail lists. So there will be a huge response to that without question. And I talked about this phenomenon before. Business travelers travel to hotels. They never get outside. The idea of being able to experience a country within a single property is becoming increasingly important.
Very good point.
And doing that through beverage is important. So, yes, you know, locally made sakis, any locally made spirits. You know, there isn't the industry that there is in the United States, but whenever I'm over there, if I'm in Hong Kong, I'm using, you know, I saw a drink they doing Audrey Sanders Earl Grey Martini, and I was like, with all the tea you have in China, why the hell are you doing an Earl Grey Martini? You know, there was somebody, you know, who's using sherry in a drink, and I was like, you have Shaoxing rice wine, you know?
Right.
So there are all those flavors that
take
haven't
a little
yet
pride in that and what you have and,
exactly.
and showcase it.
All these consultants are coming from New York and wanting to plug their same recipes in. There's so much interesting stuff. That's why you need to spend time over there. You know, it's not the buzzword that it is here in the United States, but they really appreciate when you actually respect their culture and really have a new appreciation for beverage when you bring it into beverage. And that will be, you know, you've got wineries in India now, you know, you've got, you know, China making vodka. All those things will come into play, you know, eventually.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for your time. Stick around New York a little longer.
Without question. I just want to describe the shelf over to my right here.
Please do.
First aid kit and the fire extinguisher. Then there is a half bottle of vodka, a bottle of cheap Suave, and something that looks like either a really ornate grappa or a water pipe. I'm not sure.
Or potentially a new tequila.
And then
the
there's some Windex as well. So, you know,
we're drinking really fine inside the Heritage Radio
talk
Network
about what
studio.
Fantastic wine that Aaron brought me out here for. But we had a great lunch at Roberta's, and thank you for bringing me out here.
Thank you.
It was great
Thanks
to do
so
this.
Much.
Thank you.
Okay. See you next week.